Partizane njih gut, partizanen kaput.
Intervju Radija Študent.
Današnji RKHV intervju bomo namenili pogovoru s kustosinjo in teoretičarko Suzano Milevsko. So kustosinjo razstave Narobe obrnjeno, ne tako bela kocka, ki se ima drevi otvoriti v Mestni galeriji Ljubljana. Razstava je del večletnega raziskovalnega projekta in za refleksije same razstave bo še dovolj časa. Že v kulturnih novicah smo omenili njeno pot, ko se je od kritičarke prevesila v kustosinjo in njeno delo, ki ga opiše sintagmo kuratorica idej. Njena profesionalna pot je impresivna. Kurirala je preko 70 mednarodnih razstav, je avtorica in urednica številnih publikacij in raziskav. Njeno zanimanje med drugim obsega filmsko teorijo, fotografijo, psihoanalizo, študije spola, nacionalne identitete in institucionalne kritike. Doktorirala je iz vizualne kulture v Londonu na Univerzi v Goldsmithu. Med drugim je bila direktorica Centra za vizualno in kulturno raziskovanje Euro-Balkan inštituta v Skopju, poleg tega je delala kot predavateljica na številnih katedrah po svetu. Nazadnje na Akademiji za likovno umetnost na Dunaju. Kot prva profesorica vzhodnoevropske umetnosti je prišla v konflikt z Erste fundacijo, ki je cenzurirala njeno knjigo. Suzana pa je bila na Akademiji suspendirana. Suspens v začetku tega leta je zbudil odpor študentov, saj so ustvarili peticijo imenovano Free Suzana Milevska. Suspens je bil sicer dvojen, istočasno je bila nezaželena na tej instituciji, po drugi strani pa ji ni mogla zapustiti, saj je na njo vezala pogodba. Sedaj je nazaj v Skopju. Suzano smo se usedli prvenstveno z vprašanji o njeni vlogi kritika v dveh navidez različnih državah, Avstriji in Makedoniji.
Because of the Skopje 2014 project, which I mentioned during the lecture, I guess this is what you refer to. And this is very expensive, first of all, 500 million of euros is estimation, and also very visible. It's really a project that includes lots of architectural objects, buildings, sculptures, and monuments. So it's three-partite project and it covers the complete center of the city. And when you enter Skopje after several years, now you cannot recognize the city. The main aim of this project is exactly to compensate this lack of identity, which was struggling with all these different issues, like the name issue coming from the Greece government and many other aspects, because Macedonia is not part of EU exactly because of this issue of the name. And, you know, this kind of a challenge from the Greek government, which supposedly owns the copyright to use of Macedonia. I worked a lot on these topics with my renaming machine project, which was actually produced in Ljubljana. And these all questions are related. When you say persona non grata, it's not as if I'm censored in Macedonia, because most of my works, my texts are published elsewhere. But, you know, this is a fact that I am not employed in any institution, or I have never published a text in any local journal or magazine for years. I have never received any support for my projects, including the renaming machine, which is interesting because it was all about the name issue of Macedonia, but I never received any funding, any support from the state, exactly because I questioned all this ultranationalism and how the government responded to this issue. How we responded? By renaming every major object or road with Alexander the Great. It's not serious enough. It's what I call false identity, compensating the lack of identity or lack of strong identity with false identity is not the right way to answer in my regard. I wrote a text in Influx journal about this. The quote is also from an older text that I published here in Slovenia in Maska journal, which was the first text that I published about this interpretation of Macedonia as state of exception. Because my major contribution to this topic, as far as I understand this, is that I interpreted, you know, this result, this book in 2014, as a result of this long-term delay of establishing this state with a proper name and recognition from the European Union as state of exception in a Gambian terms. I can tell you one little anecdote that when I won the Igor Zabel Award, they sent the director of the Macedonian TV to make an interview with me in Warsaw because of this award. And we did sit there. We had a one-hour interview where I talked about the renaming machine and how I see this as a critical point that should be tackled. The interview never was, you know, broadcasted.
The other part would be, I suppose, is that you you work very internationally, and with your criticism you address to the international readers and to it with Igor Zabel. But you also mentioned Igor Zabel, who tried to censor one of your books, and they some bureaucratic hold where you were not allowed to leave without some formal meeting.
It's really important for me that you ask this question here in Ljubljana, because I feel very responsible about this award. You know, what I say here, it's not the same as what I say elsewhere, because when I got this award, I was really proud. I still haven't reconciled with this issue. It's too early for me to talk about that. It's very sensitive, it's very personal, emotional, but at the same time, it's very political. Because I came across recently to this really sexy term, philanthropic capitalism. And this is all about that, you know. The promise of this award, the promise of the Erste Foundation with this new position that I was the first holder, the first professor of Central and Southeastern European art histories, was that this is opening up to intellectuals, to ideas from our region. So it's actually this philanthropy. But what is happening behind closed doors is completely the opposite. What I felt as on a personal level was that you are given your place and you cannot really go beyond that. You cannot really try to be critical there on their own topics. Because, you know, we all from the Balkans and from Southeastern Europe go to the West with big expectations of democracy. I explained the situation in Skopje as a very close society. And then you expect that something better is going on abroad. But then you go, you come across very similar issues or even worse. And you, as a critical person, you need to respond. And that's when you understand that actually there are limits to how much you're allowed to criticize. This is something that I still need to somehow phrase and, you know, in theory, to produce a theory about that. But that's not maybe the time now. Not yet. Exactly because of this forthcoming project, which will address some of the issues of transformation of I'm talking now about my coming back to Slovenia as a co-curator and a future with a project with the Mestna Galleria and Museum of Ljubljana. It's really more important for me now to formulate all these conflicts in theoretical and critical terms, not to stay on the level of personal experience.
Revolutionary culture has to concentrate on the formation of non-teachable bodies. Of course, the teachable bodies Foucault is talking about, bodies which were created by the disciplinary power, are continuing on with their march all over the planet.
Del intervjuja se nanaša na vprašanje subverznivne identifikacije. Na termin, ki bi moral biti arhivski, a je v Sloveniji čedalje bolj aktualen. To je bila tema njenega lanskega predavanja v moderni galeriji v okviru male šole parazitivizma. Subverzivno nadidentifikacijo je sicer v umetnostni diskurs po Altruzeju prvi upeljal Slavoj Žižek v navezavi na delovanje Laibachov SFRJ. A termin se pri nas obuja, aktualizira in predvsem institucionalizira. Suzana je na predavanju predlagala termin obratne rekuperacije. Vprašali smo jo o aktualnosti subverzivnosti in na vse zadnje o smislu kritike v morda bolj totalnih razmerah kot kadarkoli.
think it's important to not to forget the original context, when exactly and where this this term was coined. Because when we talk about over-identification now, the whole system changed, you know, the kind of difference between the time of the original coining of the term and now is too big to be able to use the term in the same way as it was used. So I think that the major problem here is exactly about this forgetfulness of the art communities and the art system of this very concrete social, socio-political context, you know, when different concepts are emerging. You know, as we know, to remind that the original time of emergence of this term was the time that precedes the split of Yugoslavia. And at that time, that you know, over-identification as a kind of phenomenon or as a kind of method, artistic practice, whatever you call it, or just maybe in the context of Laibach, you know, it's really maybe even a kind of performative action on media, because that was you know, the original context, the interview that Laibach gave here. It's in the exhibition, you know. This is really important, always to remember when this term was coined and why this was important and why Žižek wrote what he wrote. I don't want to refer all the time and to quote all the time Žižek, but this is when this question was important, and he was so clever to somehow summarize this, to encapsulate the whole situation, thinking that the stage was actually frightened, or was in a way threatened, felt threatened. And this is why there were lots of scandals about that, there were lots of censorship because of this threat. The question, what with this term now, what we can do now, is really important, because now I don't see the state trembling. That in a way the state can be threatened, but also can encapsulate and incorporate and recuperate itself with any criticism, which is actually the time that we are living. And that's why over-identification, I'm afraid, is not so strong a source of threat anymore as it was at the time when it was born. When I talked about this topic actually in Moderna Galleria, I was not referring so much on these older cases of over-identification, but I saw as problematic some more recent practices, like, for example, reenactment of human zoos. If you remember, and for me this is even more problematic, you know, when you recreate human zoos, and this is humiliating for me, you know, as a human being, that I need to see the human zoo in order to understand that humans are not supposed to be treated like this. Is it, you know, what they expect, you know, why we don't trust ourselves more and try to find different ways than to just repeat and enhance or exaggerate these terrible practices from the past. And this is the same like nationalism or ultranationalism, which is in a way in this question of over-identification always in the background. You know, why we need to over-identify with the state in order to make visible, you know, some mechanisms that we don't agree with.
But the state is very strong in Macedonia, and it has a clear ideological agenda concerning identity. And as you mentioned, well, in Slovenia, it's not quite clear in that project, or a troublesome project. Everybody will write critical texts, but in the end, it will just help to legitimize the the project.
That's the question of recuperation, and this is something that I already referred to, because this is something that Guy Debord noticed, you know, that the institutions or the state, so this is two different things, you know, that but they are powerful because the institutions are legitimized by the state, and they in a way incorporate all this criticism because they have the last say. The last say is not of artists or critics or philosophers. The last say is always on the state, and they always cover up everything and, you know, always suck up everything. But I was always interested in what are the steps that you can do, you know, beyond this maybe expected, you know, phenomenon. It's not something new. It's, it was always, you know, a kind of trouble relation between the critiques and, you know, the state. How to deal with that? You had dissidents for the same reason in former East. You had inner dissidents in Yugoslavia, you know, where people were just a kind of very reluctant to talk anything, exactly because of this fear that whatever they will say, it will be either accumulated and, you know, recuperated, or they will be expelled, you know. So they went in the kind of inner dissidentship, personal withdrawal from the state. But your question now, at this moment, is an important question, but unfortunately I don't have the answer, you know, how to fight with this, because so my possible, you know, kind of, not answers, but maybe directions, are alliances, solidarity among these critical voices. Because if we assume, if we know already that the state is big, as it happened so many times in my life, it's very important to understand that individual criticism does not have any chance. You will be always won and, you know, erased. I was erased from Vienna. I am going to be erased by many publications because I raised my voice. And I tried, actually, and the good thing about my situation was that the students made alliances with me, which was one of possible, you know, kind of solidarity. But this is not enough, exactly, because the students are not part of this system. They don't have the power. On the other side, you know, if you always team with the power, that's another danger. Because, you know, if you team up with the other people that are on the opposition, you accept actually another kind of power. So it's really an inner contradiction of criticism, this inner kind of double consciousness of, you know, critique, that is very difficult to deal with, and that's why I devoted many of my texts and now this project, you know, future projects to this topic, because there is no one simple question, you know. It's really important not to generalize, to work with particular case studies and to see whether there were some people, some practices that won anything, you know, in very relative terms, because sometimes theorists expect too much from artists and intellectuals with their criticism. But what can be won exactly, you know? We are not talking about a critique that will change the world, you know? But, and I really want to end up with this statement from Ernst Bloch, if you don't have the hope, it will never change. And this is my answer to all these people that criticize me for being so open and critical about my situation in Vienna. What I expect, that I will change the world, you know, the world is as it is, so I should have suck it up and be silent. I didn't accept this position exactly because I really want to live in the future with hope that something will change. And all these institutions that promote change, as Erste Foundation, for example, you know, if they don't believe in it, it's a kind of paradox at starting point. It will never happen, you know. If it say that, if they say that the world is as it is, so you should not criticize, that's not an option for me. That's not a position that I want to hold. So you need to hope that you can change, even when you are aware that you're doomed to fail. You still, you know, you won't do anything if you don't hope. So it's a dialectics, you know, it's the dialectic of hope, as Ernst Bloch said.
Dialektika upanja. Zdi se, da kritika dobiva status molitve. Je strašno čislana in zaželjena, a le v mraku svetišč. Današnja razstava v Mestni galeriji Ljubljana in raziskovalni projekti vezani na njo bodo skušali odgovoriti ali bolje rečeno drugače postaviti vprašanja in razmerja načeta v tem pogovoru. Skupinska mednarodna razstava Narobe obrnjeno, ne tako bela kocka v sokostostovanju z Alenko Gregorič se bo odprla drevi ob 8. Intervju je pripravil Miha Turk.
Intervju Radija Študent.